Hey, how you doing? My name is Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic addict. And I start off by, I never started this way, but you know we do the reading, and we read before we have the meeting. And I can never forget when I made a turning point in my recovery was in Atlanta. It was in the Bluff, and I was going to a meeting in the Bluff. So I was going to a meeting at the Bluff, and I had about 3 months clean. And a female walked up to me and said, how come you're not in the meeting? I said, well, they still reading. I'm smoking a cigarette. Get out of my face. You know, I said it worse than that. But I went on in the meeting anyway, and I still took the reading for granted. And the first, I call it a spiritual awakening. The first spiritual awakening I had was at a celebration about, like I said, 3 or 4 months out. And a guy got up and did the reading, and it took about 10 minutes to read, and this happened to be an NA, but to read how it works. And people were trying to help him, you know, with some of the words. So the chairperson said, don't help him. Don't help him. Ooh, okay. And the guy stuttered through. And finally he got through and he said something that changed my life. He said, I got 15 years clean. And this is the first time I ever read out loud. I didn't start to learn to read to 5 years ago after he had 10 years. And I went, whoa. Now what's my excuse? You know. And right after he did that, a blind girl got up and did the promises and did it by memory. Okay. Now, what the hell is my excuse in getting this program? It eliminated them right there. I mean, because I came in after picking up my first white chip in 1980, being around the room 27 years, I finally decided and made a decision to surrender in 2007, September 27, 2007. I have 4 years, 6 months clean. I, you know, took a lot for granted about the program of recovery. And that moment right there changed my life. Because here was a guy who got out of his comfort zone, and Kelly asked me about being nervous before me. When I stand up in front of a crowd and speak, it's out of my comfort zone. Me living in Kennesaw is out of my comfort zone. I'm from the Bluff. I'm from the inner city. Looking at that mountain out there is out of my comfort zone. But I'm okay with that, you know, because God got me where he wanted me to be. Okay, let's run with it, you know. And I really did get comfortable with three of my kids walked in, three young people. They weren't here to introduce themselves. But, and I'll get to that later, but I did, you know, I got them. Okay, some of them showed up. That's good. But anyway, and just imagine how this guy, first time reading, 15 years in the program, having the courage to stand up and read in a crowded room for the first time. He got out his comfort zone, and he grew. A blind girl getting up and reciting the promises, the girl couldn't read Braille. Reciting the whole thing by heart, it was like, whoa. And then right there, it had an impact on me that I'd never forget, and I just wanted to share that. But I started 1980. In the summer of 1980, I picked up my first white chip. I heard about AA living in Albany, Georgia. I was homeless. And at times I worked off and on. I stayed by the Flint River in a shack when I was working for a guy cleaning cow. And I was, it was a job. Yeah, it was a job. And I was surviving. Okay. And one guy told me about, well, it's a group of people, because sometime at night we get hungry if we didn't make any money. Well, I know if, well, you can go get some donuts and coffees and cookies and, Well, this place, man, they'll let you come in now. You know, you can sit around. Now, they talk about drinking. Now, I know some of you probably got the same story. I thought, because see, I thought in 1980, AA was going to show me how to drink. And then this guy gave me a book and I wanted to be my sponsor. Uh-oh, I'm in the wrong place, you know. And but he told me something I never forget, and I tell people that today. If you come into the room at AA, it will mess up your drinking for the rest of your life if you choose to go back out. Once you hear that there's a choice and there's a way out, and you choose to go back out, okay, you're on your own. But I picked up that white chip and I said, okay, and I got that book and did some step work on my own without a sponsor. I got this. Okay, tomorrow I'm going to do step 5 and I'm going to do step 6. Oh, I don't need them last few steps. And, okay, I got this. And went back out, and a few months later I was back drinking. And it's funny how it go, because I would go to any length to get my alcohol. Any length to get my alcohol. So I was working with a guy. We was working on the Civic Center in Albany, Georgia, 1980, by the Flint River. And they built the Civic Center. And I was an iron worker among a lot of other jobs I had. And he happened to be a white gentleman. And he, hey, man, it's Sunday. What are we going to drink? He didn't want to come to Harlem. That was the black side of Albany, Georgia. That, okay, I'm not going down there. I said, well, where do you go on Sunday? And he said, well, I go to this bar between here. It was in Worth County, between Albany and Sylvester, Georgia. But I don't think you're going to want to walk, go in there. And my answer was, do they serve alcohol? Yeah. Well, let's go. Well, Jeff is, you know, the rebel flag and all this. And he tried to warn me, but I was determined that I don't understand. If they serve alcohol, let's go. Why are we still here? And it was just like out of a movie. We come down this long dirt road with one bar in the middle of nothing. I mean nothing. A big rebel flag, motorcycles, hound dog, the whole works. And I'm like, what the hell I got myself into? Now, let's go ahead and get this alcohol. I got to have a drink. So I went in and I got all, now it's 1980. I got the look, well, you know the kind of looks I got, you know. So we'll go in and we're sitting down. The guy went on ahead and served me a beer. I'm still getting these looks, and I, you know, country music song came on, and I knew the words, and I sung it. And they looked around, and what the? And they put on another record. I was singing that, nigga. And I'm not going to sing it. But anyway, I cut that off. No. But anyway, I sung it, and, oh, man. No, I'm not going to sing it there. But I sung the record, and they... Boy, you all right. You know, I got this immediate acceptance. People buy me beer. But another part about that, see, I'm 55 years old. If any of you got some black friends over 50 that grew up in the South, here's a test I want you to do. There are 3 shows that everybody watched on my street. Now, this is late 60s, early 70s. 3 television shows. Some of you already know it. One was Andy Griffin, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hee Haw. Every Saturday night, we watch Hee Haw, you know. And, where are you tonight? Why did you leave me here all alone? I searched the world over, thought I found true love. Y'all know that, bro. Some of y'all know that. Some of y'all know that. Some of y'all old enough. Some of y'all old enough to know that. Yeah, you know it. You know it. You know, so Merle Haggard and all them, hey, I was a Hank Williams fan and all that. A lot of people don't know, soul singer Al Green did a Hank Williams tribute on every album he made, the first 4 or 5 albums. And a lot of people, they didn't know, y'all know country music. But that was, we had 3 television channels. That was all on TV. You know, TV used to go off at 12 o'clock. Yeah, seriously. But anyway, so then, you know, then my career drinking took back off. But I had a taste of AA, and first of all, I was down in Albany because I committed a burglary. I jumped bond, and I went to college in Albany for 1 year in 1975-76. Let me go somewhere and hide out where I know the city, and I did. I was in Albany, got busted, and originally when I went into the office of the public defender, the reason I jumped bond because when the public defender said, I can get you 10 years on this burglary, well, you can get yourself 10 years. I'm gone. And I left, and I got a bus ticket and left town. I get to Albany and show you how alcohol played a part in my life. All that time, all year, even one police was a friend of mine. So I had no problem. I'm wanted by the law. I did a little work because we picked pecans down there, and you picked cucumbers, and you picked collard greens. So I'm doing this work where I can make cash money, and I'm drunk, and I had this lady I was staying with. I left out the house, man. I got drunk. I stumbled into the police in the Shoney's bar. He asked me, did I have ID? And I reached for my wallet and said, no. Well, what are you reaching for? He got my ID, saw that I was wanted, brought me back to Atlanta. And to show you how God worked, and he was looking out for me when I really was not looking out for myself, got in court, did 3 months in jail, and they said, time served, go home. I ran because he said 10 years. But God worked that out. But I still didn't have no gratitude to toward God. So here it is, 1980. 82, I go into rehab. 83, I go into rehab. 84, I'm at Fulton County Alcoholism Treatment Center back then. In 84, you could not go in Fulton County Alcoholism Treatment for drugs. So that's how far I go back. You had to say alcohol. And I went in and I had a counselor, and these type of things had an effect on me and always showed me there must be a way out. My first counselor in 83 told me, why don't you switch to marijuana? My second counselor in 84 told me, now he said he had 20 years. He told me, if you're going to get drunk, get you a hotel room, tell your people where you are, close the door, get your drunk on, and get it over with. So I kept seeing all these out. So in 84, again, in 85, I went in a church program. And then in 86, you know, anyway, you see the pattern. On and on and on, I kept running in. I kept going in the room, but trying to find a way out. Going in the room, but it must be a way out. And when we do the reading, our life had become unmanageable. Now, I agree with that part since 1980. But that powerless part, I'm not done trying. I got to have a little power over this. I got to have a little power over this. Well, through the mid-80s, a lot of stuff happened to me. I don't say this as a badge of honor, but being hit by a car, being shot, being stabbed twice, falling off a two-story building, turning over. If you have been on a construction site, I used to drive a lure. Turned that over and only twisted my ankle by the grace of God, and the rest of it fell. I had all these things that kept happening, and each and every event. Now, mind you, finally in the 90s, crack cocaine came along. I had to try that. But all these events in the 80s, every last event occurred under the influence of alcohol. Every last event. You know, going through a windshield when I had no idea. I still had a scar on my head. I can't tell you, you know, in the hospital when I woke up, do you know where you are? You know, you're a nurse, Carol. I don't know. I still today really don't know what happened, you know. And they wired my mouth shut, and my mother was living at that time. I'm back at her house. They got my mouth shut, and all my friends heard about me and what happened. And the insanity of alcoholism told me, y'all go get me some beer and a straw. Seriously. your mouth wide. You can't eat. Damn, Eden, get me some beer, a straw, and some MD 2020. Seriously. No, seriously. Come on, you know. Now, with my mouth wide, I'm weighing about 140 pounds, 6'1", and dropped off on that. So that was the insanity of what I was doing. And I look back now, my mother passed away and gone. Wow, what did I put her through? You know, because I was her only child. And matter of fact, I had to go to Al-Anon to kind of understand something about my mother. I know I'm skipping around, but my mother was the greatest enabler that walked the face of the earth, because I didn't understand how she kept letting a grown-ass man continue to eat her food and sleep in her house and not working a day. I mean, we who are old enough, we get a Social Security printout every so many years. Every 5 to 10 years, you know, you get a Social Security printout of all the money you made. And I'm not proud of it, but I had a 10-year period with zeros. Zero. Now, I didn't go without money during those 10 years. There's ways, you know. But that's my background and all that. But she put up with me like that. And then my aunt told me something in my recovery this time that really changed the way I looked at what she did. Because when I was 5 years old, I was rushed to the hospital with pneumonia. And in 1959, 60, in those years, they put me in a bubble. They put my upper torso in a bubble. And they had a breathing apparatus and all that, and it was draining the fluid off your lungs when you have pneumonia back then. And I do remember a gentleman who happened to be white, and he had a collar around him. And mind you, I'm 4 or 5 years old. I didn't understand. And that was the chaplain giving me my last rites. I was not supposed to leave the hospital. And my aunt told me, that's why every family member you had came to that hospital, because you was not supposed to come home. Now, she said, Jeff, what you don't understand, for the rest of your mother's life, her job was to keep you alive. That's it. She put up with your crap because she always saw that five-year-old son she almost lost. And that's why she put up with your crap. We didn't put up with your crap. They were not co-signers. And I had a lot of crap. My aunt, my two aunts who are still living today, and it's a funny story, and some of them know about it. My two aunts who are living today, some of you got that relative problem. Some of you been that relative. I was the relative when he came over the house, and I knock on the door. Is that that boy? Yeah, hold up a minute. Hide the pocketbooks. You know, make sure all the money put up it. And seriously, if I go in the house, where you going? To the bathroom. Y'all walk with him. I mean, to the bathroom, you know. And I understand that now. But when I got clean and sober, that same aunt who had an insurance policy on me after my mother died and said, you know, I think I'm going to be cashing yours in for like they cash mine. Because that was the path I was on. That aunt gave me a van when I got up here to Kittesaw. Because I see what you're doing, and I see you making a difference in young people's lives. I was a house manager at Hero House, which I get to. And she just gave me this van, and this is the van she didn't want me to ride in. You know, they would see me walking down the street drunk, but Mama, my cousin said, Mama, it's raining, let that boy walk. I don't want him in my van. Let him walk, you know. But all through the 80s and then getting in the 90s through the crack cocaine and everything, I kept continuing to come back into the rooms of recovery, but I kept wanting to do it my way. And then, so many things happened, you know. In 2003, my mother died, and I had a period where I actually put down drugs and alcohol to take care of her before she died. Now, the insane part about it, she died of lung cancer, and I still smoke, man. Okay. She died of lung cancer. Now, I'm watching her die because she was defiant in not going to a convalescent home And she said, that boy gonna take care of me if it's the last thing he do. Well, I had family came from South Georgia and everywhere else to see this miracle that happened. Me taking care of my mother and putting somebody in front of me. And I did. And then on the night she died, where's that alcohol? I picked it up. Let's go. I got to make up some time. I've been away from alcohol. And my family was puzzled because you could do that for her and you can't do it for you. So from 2003 to 2007, my family cut all ties with me. I don't have any brothers and sisters, never been married, don't have any kids. I thank God he answered that prayer for me not to have kids, because when I was young, I always said I wouldn't want a father like me, because I didn't love me, I didn't like me, I didn't know me, and I didn't care about me. So why would I want a child to be born under that? Well, 2003 to 2007, I got left her house, and it was very dilapidated. It had a hole in the roof. I had rats, and I'm serious, as a heart attack. I had rats, and I tried to get rid of them and this and that. Finally, I started feeding them, and that's just how it went. That's just how it went. And they would come across the bed. I would leave food. We got along. We had a cat that would kill the snakes, and she would kill the rats, and it was just harmony. But we got along. Now that kept a lot of people from coming to my house, because when my mom died, you could smoke your crack cocaine, and I would smoke it with you. But if you had the alcohol, give me that alcohol first. I'll get to that crack later. Let's do this alcohol. So a lot of people would come, then they would run out the house, they see a rat, and I'd name them all and this and that. And really, I knew I was insane with that picture. I just thought about that. But that's the God honest truth. You know. And then, during 2003-2007, in the inner city, there's a lot of churches that have bread lines, soup lines, clothes lines. A lot of people have churches that do this and that. So even in, too late to go get food stamp, I went to a lot of bread lines. And the most insane thing happened one day, somebody said, cause I had all this time by myself and I would read this, watch this, do this. And somebody asked the question, need to know the answer to some outrageous question. And we standing in the bread line and somebody said, ask Jeff. And I'll be doggone if I didn't know the answer. And somebody said, yeah, he the smartest one in the bread line. What the hell? Well, why is I'm in a bread line, you know? And it dawned on me, and that's the kind of insanity I was, because, see, we tell our stories in a general way, what it used to be like, what got you out and how it is now. You know, how deep was the hole? How did you get out the hole? What you do to stay out the hole? Well, there were a lot of people in the hole on Bankhead Highway. A lot, you know. She just died this year, and bless her heart, but limousine comes up, we're at the service station, and we so used to it. Hey, man, what was that in the limousine? Well, that's Whitney Houston. She's on Bankhead by her crack like we are. I mean, you know, that's plain, that's just how it was, you know. And when I took a tally when she died, I was telling a friend of mine, in 1 year, that was the 21st person I had some kind of association with or knew that died in 1 year. In 1 year from the disease of addiction. And that number keep growing. But you know, to get to it, now I'm keep going here. Between 2003 and 2007, I lost all contact with my family. They didn't want nothing to do with me. So that meant Christmas alone, Thanksgiving alone, everything. And a strange occurrence happened, a true story. I think Brian know about this, but we sitting in the house. I don't know if you know, but we sitting in the house, and me and a friend of mine's We woke up that morning, and there are five naked women in my living room, asleep. And I asked him, did we do anything? He said, no, you grabbed that ball and you went in your room and went to sleep. Five, and I went to sleep? Yeah. So I got to look at that. Because I had all these fantasies in my head, you know. Wow, what would I do? And I went to sleep. He said, man, you grabbed that bottle of Old Thompson. You went in your back room. You didn't even come out and smoke crack. You went right to sleep. Wow. So, you know, okay, I done lost it. I'm gone now. I'm gone. But an occurrence happened in 2007. And this was the greatest moment of my life. And I really mean that. In July 2007, my house caught a fire. And that was the house my mother left me. And just so happened, by only the grace of God, I woke up because I was coming off of a drunk. Woke up about 2 o'clock, went to my neighbor, didn't have any food in the house, didn't have a refrigerator, anything. Was going to get some food from her, and she looked over my shoulder and said, I think your house on fire. And I looked behind me and said, yes, it is. You know. Now, my cousin reminded me of something I put out there, calm as a bitch. My cousin reminded me of something I said, because I would not fix the house up. It was dilapidated. I said, if God let that house burn down, I'll go get help. And my cousin reminded me of that. Yeah, I did say that. So I turned around and went to a place called Jefferson Place. And just so happened, I was one day late getting into the program to get recovery. That was in July. They said, please come back. So that left me from July to September the 26th. Out there. Now, the Red Cross gives you a card with they give you a hotel room for a couple of days. They give you a card where you can get food and this and that. And of all the places they put the hotel was on Food and Industrial. And the liquor store was right next door. And he took the card. And I sold the clothes I got, and I started making my way just around. I'm out there. So July to September, I'm out there with the clothes on my back. And that means no bathing, anything, no shaving, just out there. I'm really confused, don't know which way to go. And finally, I was did a little work for somebody, made a couple of dollars, was on a MARTA train. And I know this is a higher power in my life because I'm on the MARTA train and it goes behind the airport. Now this is after 9/11. They are very serious about anything you do at the airport out the ordinary. Anything. The guy, and I had all these empty bottles on the seat by me on the train. The policeman, the operator called in, we got a guy asleep. The policeman brought the train, the guy brought the train back. The policeman came, woke me up, and I wasn't staggering. I was coherent. Sir, you're not allowed to be sleeping going in the back of the airport like that. And we can't arrest you because you have no alcohol in those containers. And I wanted to be arrested. And I began, they took me back to Fort McPherson because they can't leave me at the airport because there's no way for you to walk from the airport. It's all intersection. The train brought me to Fort McPherson and they put me out and they said, your name will be put on a list at the airport. We suggest you don't come back there anymore. And matter of fact, we suggest you don't even ride MARTA tonight. You get off and find your way home. Now this is 2 weeks. And in my mind, I gotta go get help. So from Fort McPherson to the Bluff, Jefferson Place, the place I went for recovery, I started walking. And on the way walking, a lot of people offered me something to drink. Very few people offered me food. I'm feeling weak, I'm tired, and I'm really at the bottom. This is it. This is it. And finally, I get 100 yards from here to the street outside from Jefferson Place, and I'm stuck in a shack in an abandoned house on a garage floor sleeping for 1 week. And this guy's bringing me beer and a piece of chicken, and that's it. And I'm stuck. Now, rehab is right down the street, and I can't put one foot in front of the other and go. And I'm laying there on, I'll never forget, it was the Sunday, the 26th of September, 2007. And I said, God, I thought you had a better plan for my life. And this voice is like you hear my voice right now. And he said, I did, and you got in the way. And the guy saw me look around. He said, you all right? I said, well, I bet not. I asked him, did he hear that? Because he's going to think something wrong with me. I got up and went in there, and I knew it was time, you know. And I didn't look back. Now, that was that Sunday. That Monday, I'm at Carol. We were going to Tango together. And she watched a lot of us come in. We come in kind of rough. You could admit that now. The men from Jefferson Place, we come in with beers and hair, and they throw us some clothes, and we come in kind of rough. And she remember Willis and Patrick, and all these guys had these saying. And I'm sitting there quiet because I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm listening to these people share, and they come from Lenox and stand up here, and we come from the shelter. And I'm sleeping with 150 men because Jefferson Place, before you can go to transition to living with 50 beds, see where you make it with 150 men. And they don't have to be in recovery. And they can come in smelling like alcohol every night. And they will challenge you. They will challenge your manhood and everything else. And you can't get in a fight and this and that. And you got to deal with it. And I dealt with it. And then finally, I graduated Tango. And like I say, and I'm coming back to that. And then 3 months in, when I heard the guy with 15 years stand up and read for the first time, I went, whoa. And I began to read the book because what I described for you was 27 years of trying to find this thing on my own. It's got to be a catch to this. It's got to be. And I finally found it. I finally found it. And it was the promises. That was the guarantee. Wow. That's it. That's the guarantee that it worked. And it clicked for me. And then I took off to the races. I mean, I became on the west side of Atlanta, on the regional part, in the West End regional. At 6 months, I became the Serenity Keeper chairperson, and I was doing all the convention. And when we had a convention in NA, I was responsible for people, which room you would go to, this and that, and placing people, having people with orange vests to help them with parking. And this is something they never had anybody to do with less than 1 year. And how did you become so serious? And I would tell the other guys, I'm following the instructions. It's nothing special about me. My sponsor said, do this, I do this, do that, I do this, do that, that. I'm just following the instructions. I get it now. Follow the instructions. And where you see the word must, make that do. I get it. Just change that word. Do this, not must, do it. It's plain and simple for me. And what you see suggestion, make that if you don't. Plain and simple. And that sustained me because I heard a saying, you can let the problem drain you or you can let the promises sustain you. And that had a major impact on me because I came in after even 2 heart attacks and a bad back, which I still have, bad knees, They gave doctors in 2007 when I got clean. My body said, "That's it. We quit. We quit because you have been masking these pains and these other things with osteoarthritis all these years, walking around fine." And all of a sudden I get clean and I can feel every pain in my body. And I'm like, whoa, I didn't know I had that. Yeah, you got this. You got a bad back. You got a dislocated shoulder, sir. And I broke my hand and the doctor looked at the x-ray, and a true story. The doctor looked at the x-ray and said, "How much do you drink?" A lot. He said, "Sir, your hand been broken for 10 years. What? All you did was re-broke it. Wow. And that was for coming back and recovery. So, and then I re-injured that. So I had all these things going on. And every time I said, "Oh, poor me," you know, I used to hear all those sayings, pity party, this and that, you know, I would think about that blind girl standing up saying the promises. I would think about that guy reading for the first time. And not only did she say the promises, she caught two buses and two trains to get to a meeting with a cane at night in the bluff. And I got some excuses. Gotta get rid of them. Gotta get rid of them. Well, after I did all the volunteer work, was a general representative for my home group, chaired meetings, did that, I did run into a problem. In the first 3 months, because some of the guys were, didn't think they were articulate enough, some of the guys couldn't read that well and this and that. I remember being at some meetings where I would chair the meeting, do two of the readings and all that. I would get called in to be the speaker every week in our in-house group. No. And my sponsor reminded me, "Well, you do it. As long as you remember, it's not about you. It's just not about you. You know, God is just using you as a vehicle, and that's it. You are being used as a tool. If you keep remembering it's not about you, you can accomplish anything in 12-step recovery. As long as you remember that. So don't get it in your head, you know, you're the big fish in the little pond." You know, and I did, and that helped me a lot. Well, I was doing volunteer work and I started wanting to get outside of recovery. I was doing service work in recovery. I wanted to do service work in the community. And I picked up a pamphlet in Little Five Points. It was a yoga pamphlet and I turned it over because I wanted to take yoga. And they also did street meals. And now this is how I got the Kennel Saw. So I'm working at Project Open Hands Atlanta as a volunteer there and on the Jefferson Place. And I have this pamphlet in my hand and the guy I'm working with said, "You interested in doing that, yoga?" I said, "Yeah, but I'm more interested in doing this street meal. I just happened to pick up this pamphlet." He said, "Well, the girl who run that is in the next room." What? Yeah. That's why I don't believe in coincidence. Now, she is still my friend today. Now, I went and spoke to her. She said, "If you want to come out and do the street meals, we meet on Tuesday and we make the meals and we give them out on Wednesday." Sure, I do it. Now, my facility, recovery facility, was not happy about that because at that time I wasn't working it, and they believe in your first year you shouldn't work. And I do go along with that. For some of us who've been out there hardcore, we need that time to sit down, and we had to go to three, even after Tengu, we had to go to 3 and 4 different classes a day, 2 meetings a day. We used to walk miles, and that's what I miss about the inner city, because we could walk to 30 meetings in our little area, you know. But anyway, they weren't too happy about me doing volunteer. If anything, you ought to be working for money. Yeah, but I just got this need to do this. I don't know where it's going, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to follow my conscience and do this. Well, I went on ahead and joined, and I started doing it for a year. They got me into yoga classes. I took yoga classes. Do not ask me to do downward dog. It's not going to happen. I found muscles I didn't know I had, you know. But I showed up faithfully to do that. And here's the thing. The place, Task Force for the Homeless, where we gave these sandwiches out, these people had given me a sandwich. And when these people found out I was in a shelter getting recovery, and when they found out that I had been served by them, oh, it was like, wow. They had never had anybody that they handed a sandwich to come back and help them. And that opened up avenues for me you wouldn't believe. That's why I don't believe in coincidence. I told my friend, Ashley, I told her one day, Ashley, I never had a computer. I want a computer. She called me the next day and said somebody in her office walked in and said, Ashley, do you know anybody who want a computer? And she called me immediately and said, whoa, you believe in that stuff? Yeah, I do, you know, and to a certain extent. But I just believe in the power of recovery and the doors it opened me up to. Well, what happened, they came up with, and this is Kashi Atlanta Yoga Studio, somebody said, well, we got some college students coming from Kennesaw, and we want to show them the inner city and the real world and make the sandwiches. And we're going to make the sandwiches on Sunday morning, and we're going to give them out Sunday morning. And they're going to come down from Kennesaw, and they're going to be in recovery. And I actually said, well, Jeff, if you volunteer, I'll volunteer. And we volunteered. So we came and opened up the place on Sunday. Now I'm doing that, and then by this time I began to get a job. Some Sundays I couldn't make it. Oh, yeah. And the airport said I couldn't come back there anymore. Even me with a criminal record over 20-something years ago, I started working at the airport. I got FBI clearance to work at the airport. You know, I mean, that's how God works. And that blew me away, you know. And they don't know. I'm not going to tell them, you know, that I'm on the list. But so here I am making these sounds with these guys. And I never forget, Kelly, our director, you know, wanted me to sit one time in the round when we used to sit in the round, and they'll share about their experience with, giving the guys at the shelter the sandwiches. And then they got to me, and I never forget the look on their face the first time I said it. And I said, I used to be in that line just a few months ago. And everybody mouth dropped. Are you serious? You know, I got teeth in my mouth today. I'm clean shaven. And now I used to be in that line, you know. And that's why it's important that I do this. And that's why it's important that I do this with y'all, because we would shake hands with these men as we get them a sandwich and a sack lunch. And I used to tell them, please understand, all those men, 200 men you shook hands with, not one man had any dream of becoming a homeless addict. At 17, 18, 19 years old like you guys are, not one person put on their resume, when I get 40 and 50 years old, I want to be sitting in a shelter, homeless, and an alcoholic and an addict. Nobody had that vision for their life. I hope some of them guys heard that. Because I didn't. I didn't see that vision that it was going to come for me. But it did. Well, then the director of the program one time came to me and said, Jeff, you got 2 years. I'd like for you to be a house manager in our program. I said, yes. Now, what's a house manager? I learned from my sponsor to say, yes. We'll figure out the details later. And he said, well, you'll come up, you'll stay with the guys, and you'll run one of the houses, 4 to 5 guys, and you'll be an example of recovery. So that brought me to Kennesaw. I didn't like working at the airport, and I immediately said, bye, I'm gone. And he picked me up, they picked me up, and I was a fill-in house manager in November 2009, and I came back in January 2010 and became a house manager in Kennesaw. And the program was called Hero House. And it's a program of college students in recovery, basically what it was. So here I am, a house manager. Now, here I am over 50 years old. Here I am, obviously black. And here I am, a house manager in a suburban Kennesaw, all-white golf course neighborhood. I couldn't envision that. It's no absolutely way could I see that happening. Now, I'm kind of wanting my NA and NA, but AA is down the street. Walking distance. Because, see, even though I had the van, I didn't have driver's license. Because all those years when I was kind of under the radar, I didn't have driver's license. And anyway, why mess with those details, you know? And I had to get all that done. But anyway, Cornerstone was right down the street. And Gray is not here tonight, but he came to me, one of the guys, "Jeff, you want to go to a meeting?" I said, "Yeah, is it NA?" "No, it's AA." "Yes." I learned to say yes again. You know, and there go Damon, Mike, and Thomas, and I see some of the guys sitting there, and I'm learning these new people coming in my life. And see, I heard my sponsor said, focus on the similarity, not the difference. Because coming from inner city, when some of the people would talk about their second houses, their second cars, their boat, their golf, how in the hell is I'm going to relate? But focus on the difference, because see, there's a saying, what is the saying about, well, it's a biblical saying, God is no respecter of person. This is about principles and not personalities. I had to put that in practice. And Cornerstone was so welcoming to me, and I went, whoa, okay, this is going to work. And that's in 2009 when I learned the true beauty of AA, because we would go to Triangle, but that's two buses and two trains and out the way. But I always made an effort to go. I always made an effort to go because, see, I believe that AA was always going to give me that basic, because all the other programs came out of AA. So go with the original. And that's what I did when I got here. And, well, funny thing happened by getting the driver's license. Since he's sitting here, I'm going to embarrass him. But I was supposed to go get my driver's license, and it rained. I mean, sleet, ice. Made another appointment, and it snowed. Made another appointment, and it sleeted again. And I'm going, whoa, this is not going to happen. So one of the kids gave me a ride. We're going to get the driver's license. And his car don't pass the inspection to do the license, to do the test. So I made a joke to the examiner. "I'm going to have to call my daughter." And Erica comes up. Then she came out. "That's your daughter?" "Oh, yes. Yeah, that's one of my girls." And he looked. Well, they're not really my daughter, this and that. But those group of young people in Hero House, some of them say I made an impact on their life, but I always say they saved my life. Because see, and they continue to do so by even showing up here tonight. Because my counselor, and I'll ask you a story about him in a minute, but my counselor in the drug treatment told us, you know, we sit around the round table, we're doing the group therapy, and everybody says, "If I stayed out there, I would have died. If I stayed out there, I would have died." And my counselor said, "What if you didn't? What if you didn't die? What if you wanted to be dead so bad? What if just your spirit died? What if the disease took you over so that you no longer knew yourself and you were just out there?" He said, when you walk through the cities and all of these places and you see the people who look in the garbage can, who pick up the food, who talk to the pigeons and all that, those are the people who have died. It's just the walking dead. And I used to say, after falling off a two-story building and all the tragedies that happened to me, I should have been dead. Then I learned, I had a conversation with him yesterday. No. I wasn't supposed to die. I'm here. I'm here for a purpose that my Creator wanted me to be here. I'm here at this meeting because my Creator had a purpose of me being here. And the beautiful part about working at Hero House, I'm no longer working there. They have graduated out of the program. We are still connected. What an amazing, amazing thing that people half my age are some of my closest friends. I didn't see that coming. How could that happen? But it did. Once I went back to what God whispered in my ear, I did have a plan for you, but you got in the way. And once I surrendered and got out my own way, things began to open up. Because my childhood, it resembled Forrest Gump. And I mean that seriously. It really did. Because I don't know how many else alive have shaken Martin Luther King's hand and Billy Graham's hand. And I'm one of the very few. At 11 years old, I remember my homeroom teacher, my mother was a maid and sent me to private elementary school. Now, how she did that, I don't know. She should have been a finance minister. But she sent me to private elementary school. Greatest thing she ever did for me. Because I really believe my learning stopped at seventh grade, you know, so she did that, and this homeroom teacher nephew became Maynard Jackson, the first black male of Atlanta. This lady was connected. So we going to see this minister, Rem King. Now at 11 years old, okay, you know. And we meet this man and shake his hand, okay. And April the 4th, he's assassinated. And okay, everybody know what happened. Now, because she's connected, they asked her to use us kids. Now, they had the funeral reception at Ebenezer Baptist Church. They came down the street. It wasn't even called Martin King then because he was still alive. They came down Hunter Street. Yeah, they came down Hunter Street with the casket and all that in the mule. Now, here we are at 10, 11, and 12 holding hands, and we are saving the seats for the wives and the dignitaries' wives who are on stage. Now, from here to that wall is Robert Kennedy, Frank Sinatra. Robert Kennedy said, hey, kids, Frank Sinatra. Now, you would think with these brushes with greatness, if it could rub off. Wow. But these memories didn't come back to me until I got in recovery. And, you know, like I say, standing up here is out of my comfort zone. And I can take you all out of your comfort zone because when I say this and I say that because I'm a survivor of sexual abuse. But I learned to do that because at our facility at Jefferson Place, one guy did a meeting and he talked about being sexually abused over and over for years. This guy, George, you don't know him, but this guy, George, talked about it. And how that led him to all his other actions in his life. He ended up doing 10 years for murder. Now, here George had the courage to say that out loud. And while we're outside smoking, I said, oh, that happened to me. And there were six guys out there, and we all said, that happened to me. And that minute, all of us stayed clean. I don't know how that happened. It was a lot of stuff we had to let go. And when we were able to do that, that was another spiritual awakening for all six of us. Because as macho men and men, we have the, you don't want to admit that. Well, it may make people uncomfortable, but it frees me. It frees me. And every time I have said that, you know, sometimes there's somebody who came up to me after me doing the meeting. you know. And it made me walk in the shoes when I heard a girl who talked about in her addiction being raped over and over again. I can relate. See, it showed me that I can relate to anyone under any circumstances. You know, the power for me in this program is just the fact, it's the unity of the program, but it's the fact that what I put in, I get out. Now, if I put 100% honesty in, I receive that. And that's what I'm working on today. I was telling a few people outside, I got the most drastic news because I work at Kroger's right now, and I work in the meat department there. And a kid, 17-year-old, he happened to be a black kid, came up to me and said, "Jeff, I know I told you yesterday, the other day, but I'm serious. I want to try cocaine." And I went blank. I said, "Oh, my God. God, what am I going to do with this?" And I heard his answer, "Nothing. That will be his choice." "Well, why are you sending to me? Why do you think?" It was clear why you think. Now, in coming to this meeting, I thought the message was for him, but the message was for me. That's why he sent that kid to me. That the disease of addiction is still real. And it's getting younger and younger and younger. And God right there gave me a shot of gratitude. Now, ain't you glad you out? Ain't you glad you're making the right choice today and you have turned your life around? And only by the grace of my high power am I standing here. I don't know what time. I could keep going. I have to have a filter. But it's okay. I saw the basket. I'm sorry. But anyway, thank you, Kelly, for asking me to do this. It helps me more than anything, and if I said anything to give you some enlightenment, please, please thank my higher power, because I'm just being a tool for whatever comes. I'm still learning this program. I thank y'all for letting me come out, and I will be back here again. I'm going to ask for some Tuesdays off to see you and you and you and tomorrow at our home group, which is Cornerstone, my home group. Thank you.